The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
And that's set to increase. And it's not just that there's a massive trade with Australian trade with China. Australia is one of the few countries that has a major trade surplus with China, and that's been the case for a long time. And that's been based on major expansion of minerals and rural exports to China. So a massive mining boom in Australia over the last 20 years. With Australia exporting, well, the number one export is iron ore. The Australian iron ore mines, you know, the most technologically advanced in the world these days, you know, huge mines, you know, in the middle of the desert, but, you know, transporting the iron ore to the sea by trains which don't have drivers on them or anything like that. So very high-tech mines. But as well, a whole series of other minerals, you know, massive coal exports, both for steel production and energy production in China, and growing expansion of liquid national gas exports, which comes from hundreds of miles off the coast of Australia, you know, in the Timor Sea. But it goes beyond that, you know, export of gold, of copper, of nickel, of wool, the old sort of products of like wool, and so on. So this huge growth in exports. These exports don't just go to China, they go to the rest of North Asia as well, Japan, South Korea and so on. But 70% of iron ore exports, which is the biggest one, goes to China, 70% of wool exports goes to China. But as well as that, the Australian bourgeoisie, you know, with the modernisation of the Chinese economy and so on, sees a major potential market, well, an expanding market for Australian service industries and that. So Australia is a major supplier of education services to China, huge numbers approaching, you know, hundreds of thousands, possibly approaching a million now, Chinese students studying in Australia either at university or high schools. And this is a major source of income for Australia. Australia is the highest proportion of international students in the world. And as well as that, tourism. Australia's population is about 24 million. There is a million Chinese tourists every year in Australia, and that's grown rapidly over the last 18 months with the fall of the Australian dollar. 2 years ago, Australian dollar was parity with the US. Now it's about 70 cents, and also with the rising living standards of China, the Australian bourgeoisie expects over the next decade or so to see major expansion of food exports to China, in particular dairy products. There was a brief hiccup when the global financial crisis hit. Initially, for a short period, China pulled back on its imports of iron ore and so on, and that had some impact on the Australian economy. Australia didn't go into recession, but its economy slowed. But that didn't last very long. And then after that, after sort of 6 months or so, Australia went into the second phase of a massive mining boom. And this mining boom helps explain the fact that Australia, unlike virtually any other advanced capitalist country, or maybe Norway, has been sustained economic expansion since the early 1990s. There's been no recession in Australia since then. I mean, the Chinese connection is not the only factor in this. Wouldn't want to overstate that. There's also been a massive housing boom, which is underpinned by the fact that Australia has very high levels of immigration, easily the highest in the advanced capitalist world, and that. But throughout this period, and massively accentuated by the mining boom, the rise for a whole period of the value of the Australian dollar, the Australian economy has been massively restructured. Give a feel for this. Within the next 2 years, there will not be one car produced in Australia. The steel industry is pretty much gone. The shipbuilding industry is pretty much gone. You know, so massive contraction of whole areas of the economy and that. And there's been, you know, the whole impact of neoliberalism, you know, has impacted the economy as well. You know, waves of privatisation, you know, attacks on union rights, various cutbacks in the social welfare system. That's on the one hand, though, and that clearly impacts working class people in Australia. But on the other hand, there's been, for 20 years, you've had rising wages. So wages are 50 to 60% higher than they were 20 years ago in Australia. So that obviously clearly counterbalances that. The relationship, economic relationship with China is clearly a major part of that. And so that meant that Australia essentially avoided the global financial crisis and continued to expand. You know, for a brief period of government, 6 months, but eased off a bit, then you had the economy surged again. And that whole relationship with China, you know, the political impact of that, of course, is in terms of maintaining social stability, has been very important for the bourgeoisie in Australia. You know, Australia historically, you know, had, you know, the highest, if not, you know, second highest strike rates in the advanced capitalist world. Now it's extremely low, and in the context of massive restructuring then of the economy, which could have, you know, led to major reduction of working class living standards, that's been very important. Okay, so there, you know, so clearly for the economic side of it, just, you know, massive benefits for Australian bourgeoisie. Come to the geopolitical side, of course, because this becomes then highly contradictory. And to understand that, some appreciation of that, you've got to understand thus, you know, the whole development of the Australian state and Australian capitalism. You know, with the British invasion of Australia in the late 18th century, you know, you had the setting up of a colonial settler state, you know, the dispossession of the Aboriginal people, and the whole relationship of that development, you know, very highly depended upon the developments in British capitalism. So the integration of these two economies, on one hand, with Australia being, you know, a provider of, in that, you know, commodity exports to Britain then, you know, initially for the whole historical period, that was wool exports, though gold was very important at times as well. But on one hand, the economic relationship, but then there was a military relationship. You know, he had a white colonial settler state on the edge of Asia. It was vitally dependent upon British military backing for its expansion. And the quid pro quo for that from the Australian bourgeoisie was Australia's participation and strong backing for Britain in all its wars. You know, whether it was the Sudan, the Boer War, of course, the First World War, and both Australia and New Zealand provided massive numbers of troops for the British Army. And that relationship with Britain was sustained up until the Second World War, when, you know, things, in a geopolitical sense, things majorly changed. You know, Britain by then, of course, is in economic decline and military decline as well. And in the course of the war, Australia geopolitically shifted its alliances from England to the US. Now, that was carried through fairly seamlessly, in a part because during the war there was a Labor government elected. If the traditional Conservative parties had been in office, that would have been a much more fraught thing for ideological reasons. The traditional Conservative parties in Australia were very much saw themselves as British. You know, so, you know, Conservative voters would have seen themselves as Britons, not as Australians, and that. Whereas the Labor Party was a party of Australian nationalism, the turn to, you know, the US alliance was much easier. The Labor Party's voting base is disproportionately Irish Catholic and so on, who had no, you know, it's much more, yeah, the pro-US sentiments were much easier there. And there was Republican elements and so on, and isolationist elements in the Labor Party. So that was carried through fairly seamlessly. And then, of course, after the war, the Cold War and so on, that alliance with the US was cemented. Yeah, and Australian troops fought in, you know, Vietnam, Korea, whatever, and more recently in Iraq and Afghanistan. But as well, after the Second World War, Britain's economic ties with Australia were weakened, particularly after Britain went into the EU, and America became an important source of investment. And Australian manufacturing industry much more develops after the Second World War, well, during the war itself and then after the war, you know, and that's a lot of that's based on American capital, you know, the car industry, you know, Ford, General Motors, Chrysler and so on in Australia. And America gradually replaces Britain as the major source of investment capital. Australia has always historically run a balance of trade deficit and based its whole industrialisation based on massive imports of foreign capital. Now, none of this to say, of course, is that the Australian bourgeoisie did not have its own imperialist interests. And they existed right from the start, very early on. Right from the start, the colonial settler state was more aggressively expansionist than their British backers, if you like. You know, rapidly conquered the continent against British, antagonistic relation to the British in terms of Australia wanting to seize New Guinea, Fiji, and so on, the British trying to hold them back, usually unsuccessfully. And this carried through in its relationship to the US. There was, you know, the Australians wanted American backing, but did not want American south of the equator. You know, that was seen to be American meddling. Australia should have everything south of the equator, whereas, you know, it's the way the left nationalists pitched in Australia, and this nationalism is the historic dominant current on the left in Australia, saw it as, oh, well, Australia was dragged into the Vietnam War by America. The reality is that Australia had long lobbied for America to go to war in Vietnam. You know, they saw America being involved in a war in Asia as a very good thing to back up white, you know, imperialist rule in the region. In more recent times, the Australian bourgeoisie, you know, very rapidly backs, you know, the Afghan war or the Iraq war, but very cynically. You know, oh yeah, we're the first to jump on board, but then send the most minimal number of troops conceivably possible, and so it seemed to be an insurance policy. Okay, we can make the right rhetoric, but don't do much, and you pay the lowest premium on the insurance policy. And you know, at a whole series of times, Australia wanted to be more independent. You know, it wanted to develop its own nuclear weapons in the 1950s, and then allied with Britain to try to develop them, the Americans put the veto on that, Australia having the bomb. And Australia, you know, very much saw in New Guinea, Indonesia and so on, that was the Australian thing and the Americans should stay out. Okay, now, since the 1980s, the economic ties of America have weakened. And that in the 80s, Japan replaced America as Australia's major economic partner. But that didn't really affect geopolitical situation because Japan was so allied with America. At the same time, Australian population was massively expanding. You know, in the post-war period, the population has tripled from about 8 million just after the war to 24 million today. So the confidence, the assertiveness of the Australian bourgeoisie has grown. You know, it sees itself as now as, you know, should be a player on the world stage. The other factor in this, from the 60s, you know, up to the 60s, Australia had a white Australia policy and so on. You know, that has been, you know, through the 60s and 70s, that was, you know, jettisoned and a massive turn and opening up to Asia, you know. So, and these days, you know, a third of the population of Australia are born outside Australia, massive, and the great majority of that now is Asian, and that from, you know, a whole variety of countries. Chinese speaking would be the single greatest category, but that's spread across from people, Chinese from Malaysia, Hong Kong, Taiwan, Indonesia, and mainland China. But, you know, massive levels of immigration from, you know, Sri Lanka or the Philippines or and growingly over the last two decades from the subcontinent. Now, and as well, there's, you know, a million Asian students in Australia at any one time, and the Chinese are the largest grouping in that. You know, and all those things have, you know, significant impact on the, you know, the cultural and social context in that, and will have a growing impact over the coming period. Now, yet on the other hand, you know, that's counterbalanced against that think that the whole ideological, backlog from the past, the legacy in the past of being a white colonial settler state, still, it's still the cultural norm, if you like. People much more know what's happening in London or New York than they know what's happening in Seoul or, let alone Beijing. The political establishment in this context, both Labor and Liberal parties, the Liberal Party in Australia is the Conservative Party, have remained committed to the US alliance. And indeed, over the last 3 or 4 years, have ramped that up, encouraging more American bases in Australia, as it is, there's a major American spy bases and military bases at Pine Gap and Exmouth. And clearly the Australian bourgeoisie is worried about increasing Chinese intrusion into what seems to be the Australian backyard, increasing Chinese investment in Papua New Guinea, in the Fiji and in East Timor. Australian troops are in Timor's run essentially as a colony of Australia, Australian troops occupied still. And in response to that is Australia significantly expanded its own military expenditure. Nevertheless, ramping up concerns at the military level about China, at the same time a courting of China economically. And on that level, quite prepared to break with America. This new Asian Development Bank that's been set up by China, Australia rapidly jumped on board with that, wants to be at the centre of it. The Americans, saw this as a major challenge, tried to sabotage it, and the Americans were able to pull the Japanese into line on that, but no way they were going to pull the Australians into line on that. So attention developed there. And clearly the mining capitalist bourgeoisie sees their very much their future connected to China and they're concerned that even though Australia has advantages, it's the most high-tech mine, massive reserves and so on, it's the lowest cost producer of iron ore and so on, they're concerned about the fact that if there's tensions, China will be looking for other markets. Already the Chinese are trying to diversify with, seeking out suppliers in Africa. Brazil's the main competitor with Australia for these products and so on. So they're worried about the Chinese market and that. And that means then there's, debates. There's the whole... amongst strategic analysts and so on, there's a whole significant dovish faction which argues that America's got to pull its head in, it's got to allow China to become the dominant power in Asia, and so on. And these people get considerable coverage in the media and so on. One of the best known defence analysts in Australia, a guy called Hugh White, regularly in the meeting, arguing that we've got to give China space, that our future lies with China and so on, and that the American strategy is appalling, Obama shouldn't be doing what he's doing, etc., etc. And he's far from being alone. There's obviously, some have argued that this is all based upon, these people don't want to be subservient to China either, that, we've got to play both sides off against each other to strengthen our position. And that some of them are looking for other markets, such as India, but that's economically not that significant so far, the Indian market. For the moment, the majority in the defence bureaucracy remains loyal to, and pretty stridently loyal to the US alliance. I don't think that can be guaranteed, though that's not going to be turned around in the next couple of years. The major approach then of the Australian bourgeoisie, I'd say, is, well, they want to play for time. They'd like to hope that the conflict between China and America would go away and so on. Hope something turns up in the middle, the medium term. In terms of how that plays through in mass sentiment, in many ways, it's quite contradictory. that, you know, there's obviously ideological overhang from the past about, you know, popular fears in Australia about, you know, an Asian invasion and so on, you know, defending white rule and that. And that's, you know, yeah, well, that obviously reinforces the traditional alliance with the US. But on the other hand, that should not be overstated. You know, there's, over the last 20 years, really, there has not been significant overt anti-Chinese racism in Australia. And in the last decade, that's been massively overwhelmed by, well, a hysterical anti-Muslim racism. And that, which is much more hysterical than here in the US. And that, even though there's no serious terrorist attacks in Australia or anything like it. And that combined with anti-refugee racism. But that's contradictory. See, it is the case that, you know, so a third of the population, you know, are born outside Australia, the great bulk of them in Asia. But on the issues of Muslims and refugees in Australia, they are much more racist than whites. You know, most people who come as immigrants see refugees as queue jumpers, we went through the right processes, got here, and so on. And that fits in on the Muslim question, fits in Australia is a much more irreligious society than the US. So a lot of the stuff about the Muslims is we don't want mad fundamentalists like they have in America. We've got fucking crazy Christian fundamentalists there, the Tea Party, we don't want lunatics like that, Muslims are like that, there's too much religion, you know, it's all right, Muslim. And so pitched in small L liberal secular terms. We're this glorious multicultural society, we're very tolerant, we, you know, for women's rights, gay rights, all that, you know, and if those fucking Muslims are only a bit more tolerant, and so on. So that's important. So in terms of how things play out with China. And on the other hand, it's not important not to exaggerate popular pro-US sentiment. If Obama is president, Obama's extremely popular in Australia. And that more popular than he is in the US. Massively more popular, because he seemed to be, you had a crazy lunatic running America called George Bush, and now you've got somebody who can speak English, sort of, you know, who's not a lunatic, you know, and that, and there's a real fear of the Tea Party, right, you know, it's massively exaggerated how real that is, but people think, you know, Americans are pretty lunatic, you know, people like Bush, you know, he's going to push the button tomorrow, and so on. You know, as long as there's a liberal-sounding Democrat in that, you know, in, that shores up pro-US sentiment. On the other hand, when Bush was in office, like, Australia had the biggest demonstrations in the world against the start of the Iraq War, and so on. So the Republicans were to win the next presidential election. You know, that would shake things up. And, you know, which is not to say, you know, if it became in the next decade some sort of shooting war, some showdown in Asia, which I don't think is immediate. I don't think we're able to see that I don't think in the next decade that's the immediate prospect. I mean, you can't totally rule out that, you know, anti-Chinese sentiments could be easily whipped up again if that's the way the Australian bourgeoisie decides to jump. But on the other hand, it's not as though this is, you know, most people, you know, the fact that our economic relationship with China is so vital, this is not just something that the bourgeoisie knows about. You know, this has seemed to be enormously beneficial to the Australian economy, you know, significantly lift living standards, and so on. So it's vital, so that creates tensions for the future, and that. So you'd have to say, you know, the long-term assessment is that the Australian, yeah, well, sorry, the medium-term assessment of the Australian bourgeoisie remains, you know, a cynical but loyal ally for the Americans. That's most likely to continue. That is likely to cause all sorts of tensions and frustrations, particularly amongst the sections of the capitalist class, you know, who are most more directly connected with China, and that, and how things emerge, I think, is the big unknown. And that added to that, the economic outlook is uncertain. The mining construction part of the boom has largely come to an end, and that is the biggest employer. I mean, the mines themselves, once they're operational, are not major employers. The major employment was in building the mines, building the railways, building the ports, and so on. And that's where the big money, you know, you're talking about workers on $170,000 a year sort of thing. And that's running down. So unemployment's edged up and so on. The situation is somewhat more uncertain there. So that remains open questions in terms of what happens with the world economy. You know, there's all speculation about what happens in the Chinese economy, which is, who knows. So that opens up, potential complications for Australia. In some sense, that's not seen as a contradiction. So the fact that, Iraq, Afghanistan and so on can be justified in terms of, fighting the Muslim threat, this doesn't, in a mass sense, people see the contradiction of having economic relationships with China. And you got to remember that, you got to remember the Chinese also run the anti-Muslim line. That they're concerned about, the separatist movement of the Uyghurs and so on. So that level of ideology, there's not a particular contradiction. But also, even in popular consciousness, I think at some level people are pretty cynical. You know, they know there's not many troops going, so they think, you pay your insurance policy, So most people wouldn't see there's a contradiction there with China, and most people would. Well, Obama seemed to be sane, not like George Bush, so that reassures people. But to the extent the Americans are aggressive in Asia, people don't particularly like that. In terms of the prices going down, well, a significant factor in that. See, the main way it's presented that prices have gone down because the Chinese economy is slowed. That's not the main reason. The main reason is that the two main Australian companies are exporting iron ore, who are the most efficient in the world, have massively flooded the market. So even if the Chinese economy expansion had continued and their prices were going down, and they want the prices to go down. BHP Billiton and Rio Tinto and that, the most efficient iron ore producers in the world, they're massively overexpanding. It's a bit like the Saudis are doing with oil. And they think they can blast all their competitors out of the water, send the smaller iron ore producers in Australia to the wall, hit the Brazilians and others and that. So the mining contracting phase of the boom is open. So production is massively ramped up. They're oversupplying the market, and they think the prices could be cut in half again, and they'd still make a buck. And more importantly, they can seize market share and cripple their competitors and that. So that's one side to it, and that. In terms of what the Australian economic bureaucrats had hoped is, with the end of the fall in the prices, the Australian dollar's gone down from, well, for a period the Australian dollar was worth more than the US dollar. Now it's down about 70 cents. They thought they'd like it to go lower. They thought, well, this would, make Australian exports more competitive for other things other than mining, and hope to, other sections of the economy would open up. By and large, that hasn't happened. So manufacturing hasn't recovered. On the other hand, a lot of Australian economic expansion has been based on immigration, and that brings in a lot of capital. I mean, so there's high levels of immigration, but this is not like the 1960s when, it was migrants coming in to work in low-paid jobs in manufacturing. Migrants have come in are on average earning 30% more than Australian-born. Large numbers have been bringing capital in. So there's a whole layer of people. If you bring in $2 or $3 million, you get in, and people from Hong Kong coming in, so on, and that's fueled the construction boom. So actually, that section of the blue collar working, so the construction workforce has massively expanded,
So construction, housing construction and so on. Melbourne, now where I come from, in terms of high-rise development, is more, the centre of the city is more high-rise construction than in Singapore and Hong Kong and that. So that's part of it. They also see education, universities. The university sector is geared towards, I live near Melbourne University. The area around where I live, you know, on the streets you work, at least 50% of the peak population on the streets are East Asian. So massive expansion, they see tourism, education sector, more and more the schools, they want to fund government of schools by bringing in Asian students and so on. How far these things succeed and that, and they're hoping other service industries, banking and so on. Australia has the most, it should tie into the mining boom, Australia has the most profitable banks in the world as well. So there's been massive expansion of finance capital. Well, the stuff about Rudd. Rudd was one of the Labor Prime Ministers. His ties to China were more ambiguous. Rudd was seen to be pro-Chinese because he could speak fluent Mandarin and had been part of the US Australian Embassy in China. But actually, it's pretty clear, actually, when you read the cabinet papers, he was more pro-US than the Liberal Prime Minister and more anti-Chinese and saw China as the big threat. So he posed so he could get the Chinese vote in Australia, he spoke Chinese, all that. In reality, he was more pro-US than the Conservatives. So, you know. In terms of, Abbott, who's seen as much more, you know, Neanderthal conservative, and that won, but essentially on the basis of the Labor government as being, hadn't delivered, absolute disillusionment with the Labor Party, and then, in his first budget, Abbott, introduced by Australian standards, not by European standards, but by Australian standards, fairly harsh austerity measures. There's enormous backlash against that, a reinforcement of there's still a high social democratic consciousness at a basic level in Australia, and that puts the agenda back to, the attacking the working class, attacking our living standards, attacking your pensions, undermining the National Health Service and so on. A huge backlash against that, and looked like Abbott was going to fall as Prime Minister. There was internal challenges in the Liberal Party to him, and they were going to bring in, a more smaller Liberal type. He fought that off, he hang on, and since then, he's combined pulling back on economic policies, not to be exaggerated, but the press have played up, oh yes, austerity's gone, that's an exaggeration, but it seems that way. With a sharp shift to the right on social policies and that. So whipping up, so Islamophobia has been whipped up. The fact that it's 140 Australians fighting for ISIS and so on, this has been an excuse for, hysterical policies. They're talking about, very extreme anti-terror laws, all sorts of censorship, massive attacks on the public broadcaster because they're dared to have a Muslim speak on, they're talking about stripping people's citizenship. There's a bigger Muslim community in Australia than the US comparatively. So harsh there. The refugee stuff, is over the top. But another social issues, the Murdoch press, which dominates in Australia, is hysterical. If you read the Murdoch press, it's like article after article attacking the Pope, denouncing the Pope as, a communist, basically, and all that. So it's that agenda. So Labor's still ahead in the polls, but Abbott's secure now, and as Liberal leader than that. And so it'll be an open question how things go. But it mainly has his way, because in all the race issues and so on, the Labor Party goes along with it. The Greens, who are a significant force, 10 to 12% of the vote, basically capitulated too. So the Greens are Islamophobic. The more small-L liberal you are in Australia, the more Islamophobic you are, in a way. So they pretty much capitulate all this. So if he gets away with that, he's not challenged and that. So and on one level, on economic issues, the shift to the left in Australian society, on those issues, on race issues, not all race issues, there's a sharp shift to the right.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.